If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
Proudly sponsored by you. We couldn't do what we do each week without your help, so if you'd like to show your support for Pixel Sift, you can do so right now by heading to our merch store. So that's pixelsift.com.au/store. And you can pick up some t-shirts. We've got a couple of different designs there, a tote bag, or some extremely yellow socks that I can see Scott wearing right now. He has it close to his body at all times. Very excited to wear those. And if you head to the store, you can get a 25% off if you enter the code SIFTERS. So that's pixelsift.com.au/store with the promo code SIFTERS. Hello and welcome to episode 96 of Pixel Sift. Now, it's the first time you tuned in. We're a weekly video gaming show and we talk to game creators from around the world and we ask them why they create the things they do. My name is Gianni and joining me are my co-hosts Scott.
Hello.
And Sarah.
Hello.
This week, our guest is Ian McClarty. He's the creator of Dissembler and a stack of other games. Ian, thank you very much for joining us this week. And Scott, we're also going to be checking out another topic that's been sort of making the waves online.
Yes, our topic today will be having a glance at the world of mobile games once again, specifically the highly successful yet criticized Harry Potter Hogwarts Mystery.
Let's jump in, shall we?
Yep. So really recently, there's been a lot of press coverage for the mobile game Harry Potter Hogwarts Mystery. Well, if we looked at the statistics of the game's performance, it would seem a highly successful romp from Harry Potter into the mobile gaming scene. Gaming critics seem to be tearing the game and its associates apart. But who is really to blame here?
Now, Destructoid, if you would listen to them, an article written by CJ Andreessen said that this story, though through the first year at least, is not engaging in the slightest. I could sit here and do a thing that game bloggers pretend to be journalists, pad out an article by breaking down the visuals and music and whatnot, but none of that matters when the game is this goddamn bad. And it says that the Hogwarts Mystery thinks it can try to squeeze money out of players by putting time restrictions on everything. Now, that being said,
I think it's very important to note that that is a heavily opinionated piece.
Yes. And comes from one outlet.
Yes, absolutely.
And extremely opinionated.
Yeah. And it was a bit of a standout as far as that goes. There's a lot more going on as far as coverage of the game out there.
Interestingly enough, I think so. An article in Gamasutra written by Vadim Bulatov actually said for the first week after it was released, it was firmly established in the top of the App Store ratings by April 30. It was released on the 24th, and by April 30, it entered the list of games earning more than $1 million a day. At that point, there are only 10 games on the list other than Harry Potter. And it seems to me that the success can be explained by examining the influence of five factor gameplay, monetization, development, team, franchise, and trends. So what do we think about this? It's an interesting sort of trend that we've seen, a move away from these timer-based microtransaction and gameplay for mobile games. It seems to be sort of an old-fashioned way of having it now. In the long history of mobile gaming, it's not massively long, but we've kind of moved away from that.
Yeah, absolutely. That was definitely that first generation mobile games. They were very much wait 5 hours or pay $2.
Yes.
But yeah, we have definitely moved away from that. I think the caliber of mobile gaming, as much as it is not my thing, has become better, especially with the recent adding of PUBG.
Yes.
And the other one?
Fortnite? The other one.
Yeah. Apparently, they've been quite good on mobile. I still am yet to play, although I have installed them. But you yourself have praised them highly, which is very surprising.
And they also, yeah, they have sort of moved in that direction in the way that microtransactions have moved across the industry in general. In that
yeah,
they're moving
and loot boxes in console and all the other games.
Away from the sort of advantage-giving loot boxes that are sort of requiring you to do it.
Or,
towards the more cosmetic and sort of thing. Now, Ian, you've just made a game, Dissembler, which is out on the mobile platforms. And I'm just wondering, what did you think about when you were putting together that game and thinking about how the pricing structure of that would sort of fit?
So it's sort of a puzzle-based game. It's not really conducive to any sort of free-to-play monetization, I don't think.
And you weren't thinking about maybe holding back some of the content on sort of timers or anything like that? That wasn't something that you were interested in doing?
No, I think a bit counterproductive because it's kind of you're not really having a good time if you're and things like that. So it doesn't feel like good design.
And why do you think we have sort of moved away from that when in the early days most of the sort of App Store games that we would have been playing were exactly that? They were based on timers and they were encouraging you to come back with notifications.
It's hard to say. I don't really have a lot of experience with those kind of games. I haven't really played many of them. I think there's always been done that on the App Store. I think like things like Crossy Road kind of changed that a bit where they made it. I think part of the philosophy there was, you know, you make it into play and then that's the main game. So people are entertained. And then you might, from people who are, you know, going to watch the ads or whatever.
I think it's definitely very
interesting. It's not really my perception that it's changed. I mean, every now and then I hear about some game that's got, you know, timers and whatever. Like, didn't that racing game, Wheel Racing, have timers in, or was it, am I mistaken?
Yeah, I think there has been a number of, I can't remember the exact one that you're talking about there specifically, but it's one of the things that I do see with the kind of criticism of this type of gameplay is that you're actually kind of holding people back from actually enjoying the experience, and that by sort of interrupting them with these waiting and the timers, you're actually not, people stop and they go do something else and they might go play a different game where they can get to the action immediately.
Yeah, and eventually
I mean, it has been quite successful though. I think it's like, I mean, you know, if you say they're making $1 million a day or whatever, then that's, I mean, obviously a lot of that is to do with just the fact that it's Harry Potter, right?
So yes, that's right.
Absolutely, and I think that's part of the problem.
I wonder what the demographics of that, the people who are actually paying money for that are. I mean,
and this
they're just young kids that have not played something like that before, and you know, and
that's
true. For, don't know
for some
better
money to unlock this thing, and so
what I think is interesting is that obviously the person from Destructoid is probably going to be in a, you know, maybe in a slightly different demographic, exactly as you mentioned there, and maybe that sort of game is not the one that's going to be appealed for them, and that's not what people are looking for, but maybe that is exactly what some people are looking for that experience. The article that Vadim Bulatov wrote on Gamer Sutra,
really looking for timers, but
yes,
I mean, yeah, but some people will
pay for any amount of time just to get that slight advantage, because, you know, time is the premium that you are, you know, you might have resources to do it. And I think that was part of the motivation between these older style of things, but it seems we've kind of moved away from that sort of perspective. So Vadim Bulatov, who wrote that Gamer Sutra article, says that the problem is that when you do run out of energy during the most dangerous parts of the adventures, the timing is kind of planned and you have to kind of leave your player in a dangerous situation. So adults who are somewhat more jaded to the harsh realities will put the smartphone on their pocket, but children on the other hand are much more sensitive to this, so they will be out there and going to do that.
That's a really good point, I think.
Now, I was looking at an article that had a bunch of top 10 tips for like monetizing your mobile games, and actually brought up that point is, you know, ultimately the financial success of any free-to-play game is intrinsically linked with how engaged it keeps your players, and positioning of when you include prompts to pay more money. That's a very good point. Like, to a lot of younger audiences, they would see that and go, oh, I want to buy some money. I want to put some coins into this game because I don't want my player to get my avatar to get hurt or something. But a lot of older people might just go, oh, I'll just wait it out. So it's, you know, if they're going for the target audience is maybe younger players, because Harry Potter was always a series that had a lot of young people or young adults kind of involved in it, people that are going to be more emotionally susceptible to that kind of instant gratification, whereas us older folks maybe just kind of be like, oh, well, you know, I don't want to waste my money on this, I'll wait it out. Mm-hmm. It kind of really like hones in on that particular kind of targeted marketing. I think maybe potentially, you know, people that maybe have a bit of money in their account or that they bug their parents enough, they might be able to kind of, you know, keep pumping dollars into that in those situations. So I think that's very interesting that although it puts a lot of stuff behind paywalls, from what I've seen, it chooses where to put the paywalls very carefully all the same.
Yeah. I wonder how a lot of those typical situations, like, I mean, if a young kid is not going to have a credit card.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Like, you know, to their parent, I need $5 to, like, save Harry Potter. Okay, here you go.
Didn't you ask for $5 to save Harry Potter, like, 30 minutes ago?
Yeah,
as a kid growing up, I had a lot of friends that would quote unquote borrow their parents' credit cards a lot. So yes. I would be interested to know how many of these people are unaware that their kid has got access to maybe like a PayPal account or some kind of a credit account, or was just given a gift card with a bunch of money for Google Play, or I don't know how it works, you know, and just kind of like, you know, I want to see like the difference between people that maybe, you know, have willingly given their kid money for this just to get them to shut up and just to enjoy the game, or people that are unaware that their kid is basically siphoning money out of their account into a mobile game, $5 by $5, you know?
I think it's very important to really, you know, it's not the developers here, I don't think, making these type of games, or not wanting to make these kind of games anyway, you know, it is the commercially invested parties. And with Hogwarts and Harry Potter, behind the scenes, the big commercial arm is Warner Brothers. They've just gone through two different development studios to do it. Yeah. And I think that's why we resulted in a poor game. But, like, to be honest, my problem with mobile games is the whole prepaid concept. The game's free but riddled with ads and microtransactions, so it's going to be a shit game, like, with that, unless you put money into it constantly. That's how it's designed. Mm. So, you know, that...
I think it's interesting as well. So Jen McLean, who's the director at the IGDA, said that people should stop blaming the development team for games that shouldn't be released. You're blaming exactly the wrong people. If you pick a game that you found disappointing in the last, say, 30 years, say, bad monetization, buggy, frustrating, just not fun, I'll bet money that the dev team said, please don't release this. Game devs are smart and they care about their work and they want to make a great game and they play games too. But in the large majority of cases, the dev team doesn't get to decide the release schedule. They don't get to decide monetization. They may not even decide staffing levels or product strategy. Often devs will try really hard to make an impossible release day, and they do this far too often at the expense of their health and well-being, but they do it because they want to make something amazing and wonderful that'll prompt strong emotions and make your life better. So
she's a star, isn't she?
What,
I think that's on the head.
Perfect way to sort of describe it. And yeah, I think this is an interesting game. Obviously, something is working for it. Maybe some people would look at this game and say, look, this isn't for me, or I'm against this type of game. But
on the flip side, it's working for super, him. Super popular.
So,
like, I mean, Harry Ian Potter said before, is a million extremely, a day.
It's an extremely lucrative franchise to dig into, especially in the mobile gaming scene, because despite the people that look at this product and go, well, this is garbage for these reasons, the monetization, you're going to have so many people that go, I don't care, it's Harry Potter, as they're just throwing money at it, you know, because I've seen Harry Potter fans, they are so passionate, they are so into it sometimes, you know.
I love Harry Potter.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, there's always going to be, like, an overlap between people that go, look, I don't want to waste my money on a mobile game, and people that go, I love this, I'm going to give my money to it, and they just kind of don't think about it as they're going. Because the thing with, like, such small transactions is you don't kind of think about it, and it just adds up and adds up and adds up and adds up, and suddenly you've realized you spent $50 on a mobile game, and it's like, oh, I, you know, all these little microtransactions just kept happening, you know.
Macrotransactions.
Micro to macro transactions from 0 to 100 real fast. But yeah.
With 100 clicks.
I think the real benefit is there's plenty of great games out there that you can play.
That's
sometimes that have a one-time purchase, like potentially Dissembler.
Yeah, going down the right path there.
By our guest, Ian McLarty, who joins us now. Let's jump into a quick promo and then we'll be right back with our chat with Ian.
Yeah, segue.
Mitch, what's Discord?
Discord is an online chat service that most gamers use. Incidentally, you can also use it to talk to us at pixelsiv.com.au/Discord.
Yeah, you can talk about episodes, you can talk about upcoming topics, you can probably even coerce Mitch into playing a game with you online.
That's not going to happen.
That is going to happen. You're doing it. I'm saying that's happening. Sorry.
Yeah, well...
Join Discord.
You should grow your beard back.
pixelsiv.com.au/Discord.
That swipe is so random.
Love it. Now, Ian McLarty is the developer of the game Dissembler. It's described as a subtle puzzle game about unraveling bold abstract designs one color at a time, and it has a fantastic soundtrack and sound effects in it. Very satisfying. Now, Ian, if people haven't had a chance to check it out, how would you describe Dissembler and what sort of game is it?
I kind of have a lot of trouble describing what it is, because it and it is kind of a match three game, but I kind of think of it as more of a thinky match three, mm-hmm. Or a match three where you know all the information up front, so it's much more like solving a chess puzzle or something like that, about experimenting and kind of like seeing how things interact with each other and works as you're flipping pairs of these colored tiles and flip per turn, and then at the end of each turn, all the tiles that have three or more matching of the same color appear, and then they'll stay disappeared. And can't flip with an empty spot, so that kind of creates a lot of interesting situations where match things in the right order to sort of take it apart in the right way.
So why did you decide to kind of go in that direction, and what was it about this sort of design and that you kind of pushed forward and make a game for mobile, and but it is also available on desktops as well.
Yeah. So thinking about match threes and kind of thinking, they kind of a lot of the time they're very random feeling, and you're kind of always just looking for the next match, and then you do it, and then some random tiles fall from the top. And I was kind of wondering what something that something where you kind of ahead what was coming, so you could plan for it. And that got me thinking about how could you actually represent what colors are going to replace the color that you've matched. And so that's what kind of led to the infinite mode of the game, which is you've got the tiles are sort of inside each other. And so you can see the next three colors that are coming up. So you can planning ahead and kind of this leads to, I feel like a more kind of satisfying. So that was the initial sort of design impetus. And then, and I quite enjoyed it, but I found when I was playtesting with people that overwhelming to look at, because it's very colourful and there's a lot going on. And so I thought I would make it a tutorial to the kind of concepts and kind of some sort of tricks that you can pick up gradually. And that kind of just ended up being its own thing. So I found in actually making the little tutorial levels that they were actually really interesting little puzzles on their own. So I kind of made that the main focus of the game. So I guess that's the kind of the story of how it happened.
Now, the game itself, like each level that's in there, what does it take to kind of put together one of those levels? And you know, how do you compare it to, I guess, those more algorithmically generated match threes that you might see out there?
I actually have there is a daily mode where the puzzles are generated. I found like to have a procedural generator, even though sometimes it'll generate things that are a bit easy or too hard, because you'll get these permutations of tiles that you wouldn't have thought of on your own, and kind of it leads to, oh, actually that's like an interesting interaction or interesting little concept that has been generated. Maybe I can design a puzzle around that, you know, maybe simplify it a bit, remove some extraneous bits. So I was doing about two or three a day. Then it would take me a couple of days to sort of refine them. Built my own editor. So the way I built them, I actually built them backwards, if that makes sense. So I would start with a solution, add tiles and flip them so that I knew it was always solvable.
Yeah, cool. That makes sense.
So like, it sounds really simple when you put it that
way.
Yeah,
when
obviously.
You put it that way, it's like,
of course, that's how you do it.
Of course, you do it. When you're playing Dissembler, it has a very tactile, mechanical feel, especially for a mobile game. How did you achieve this?
Because I wanted really good to interact with, particularly because, you know, back and you're going to be sort of interacting with the same thing for a while, particularly if you get stuck. Mm. So I wanted it to still feel right. So, and experimentation was kind of a big part of it as well. I wanted people to, you know, touch it and experiment with it. So so the way I did the sound effects, I wanted it to kind of feel like a sort of mechanical thing that...
Yeah, like a mechanical switch when you're flipping the colors. Yeah, that's what it's like.
clicking sounds are actually from I went to Bunnings and I just looked around for the clickiest thing I could find, or the one that sort of had the nicest sounding clicks. So I would like try like different locks and put some of them on my phone. But I found that the best clicky noise was from one of those adapters you put on a hose to water the garden, and you have all the different modes, like
yes.
Those, when you turn the little thing to change the mode, that kind of had a really nice clicky sound. Wow. So that's what all the clicks come from, is recording that. And then I did a fair bit of processing, but that's what the basis for all the clicks is.
So you stepped into many roles in this game then, sound designer and coder.
So the music, I should say the music as well was done by someone else. So that was done by Michael Berto. And I think he did a really amazing job, kind of like just sort of really pairing it back and kind of making it feel like different, but also just not getting in the way and kind of feeling contemplative. And
bouncing off of that, like talking about how you actually went to Bunnings and sought out the device that made the best clicking noise to kind of use that audio, Mitch has told us that when he's been playing the game, he gets quite a strong ASMR sort of reaction from it. Have you found that other players have had similar feedback about the game, or is Mitch just a weirdo?
What's ASMR?
It's kind of like, you get kind of like a calming, soothing reaction from a sound or an interactive experience.
Kind of a shiver.
Autonomous sensory meridian response.
Kind of a shiver down your spine.
I have had that feedback, So I think there was an article recently in Pocket Gamer where the author was talking about that. So, so it has been a thing, definitely. I think the music has probably got a bit to do with that, but also, I think they mentioned that you just go from one puzzle to the next. It's not trying to do any sort of monetization stuff. It's not trying to even offer you hints.
No.
And I guess the main reason I didn't put it in was a bit of laziness, because it's quite hard to do it, and kind of hard to make it put it in without it making it feel kind of patronizing. So, but the author of this article, her name's off the top of my head, but she said, the game, she felt that the game trusted her to get the answer.
Yeah, okay.
Like, a part of it is just like, the hints can be a bit judgy. It's like, oh, you're not getting this, are you stupid or whatever, you know? It's like kind of like, it's a bit judgy in a way.
Yeah, you don't want to fail at a puzzle game.
That relaxing, because there's no judgment. It's just like, it's just there. It's the thing. It's not really, it's just a thing, right? It's like when you buy an actual physical puzzle. This guy called Mr. Puzzle on YouTube, I don't know if you've heard of him.
But you're right, you get that satisfaction, that just like a usual puzzle, but you, at the same time, you are doing it via a sit-back technology, which is very nice.
Was that kind of a gameplay element important when you were constructing this and trying to differentiate your puzzle game in the sea of other puzzle games, especially on mobile, like making it a very relaxing and more calming and non-judgmental experience?
I don't think I was doing that necessarily to differentiate it. I think there's a lot of games that claim to be like calming and that.
Right,
But I did want it to feel, I was scared of watching a lot of this YouTuber called Mr. Puzzle, and he reviews actual physical puzzles. And so they're like little wooden sort of puzzles or different types of puzzles. And I kind of really like that idea of like a physical puzzle, because it's a thing, and it can't do anything to kind of help you. You know, it's just is what it is. And there's something in sort of inherently relaxing about just using your hands to kind of like interact with something. So I think that was more motivation than necessarily trying to differentiate it from other puzzle games. But I definitely didn't want it to feel relaxing in the same way that a lot of other games like try to feel relaxing. Like a lot of them will have this sort of ambient kind of music that kind of like, you know, sort of that wave of like, I don't necessarily find that it's relaxing.
They're trying too hard to make you relax.
Exactly. It feels like it's trying too hard. Right?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's kind of like relaxing by just pairing it back and just like reducing everything, just making it.
And I will say, that's one thing about your game. It does come across very understated, but it is quite fantastic and in depth, especially, it's essentially for a mobile puzzle game. Which is in stark contrast to a lot of the other, because I mean, personally, puzzle games are the one type of mobile game that I tend to enjoy by default, because it's a nice little brain, jolt. But your one, it was very relaxing. It would be a nice thing to do on the train or something when you were just commuting.
Ian, we've got a question from Limbot, and he's asked whether or not you have ever made anything in the sort of physical puzzle-making space, or are you only going to make digital games? Is that something you've explored?
I haven't explored it. I don't know if I will.
Why is that? Why wouldn't you? Because it sounds like you could actually make...
I guess it just sounds like a lot of work, I suppose. It's like...
Yeah, fair enough.
And also, I mean, I've got to consider, like, you know, what would the return be on that? And, like, I don't know.
It's much harder to distribute physical goods, et cetera, et cetera.
Now,
I think that could work. But it's a lot of work, right? You've got to do all the laser cutting and all that stuff. And
No doubt. Undoubtedly.
Now, Ian, you've made, to your admission, over 30 games of the last 5 years. It seems like a lot. That is a lot of games you're making. What sort of games?
Small games.
What sort of games do you make, and when do you kind of call a point on something, and what sort of things sort of inspire you to make a new game?
Really small, free games. They're all inspired by different things. It was 2016, Games of Solaris, which I made in about a week or so. And that was just really exploring a kind of a graphical kind of basically taking this graphical trick and then making just something really simple out of it. Have you played Doom before?
Yes.
I've also played a bit of Catacombs of Solaris.
We did. We played it at the No Arcade. Using
the floor mat, the dance controller. Dance. A DDR type map. I played that game for way too long, I must admit. But awesome. Like, and when you were talking about that sensory and colours, and again, going to that ASMR thing, you know, without the similarities between synesthesia type elements and your games seem to be a bit of a recurring theme here.
The idea of like exploring different ways to sort of players or kind of get gratification from a game, like instead of a score, like sort of creating visuals. I don't know. I think one of the main reasons I still do enjoy playing games is just to see new things. So, you know, the reason I want to get to a new level is to see all the new sprites in that level. Or, you know, with modern 3D games, I'm more interested in kind of just seeing the new environments. Like, to me, it's like, so like, you know, sort of exploring that idea. Like, Catacombs is also about sort of exploring that idea of, like, generated by you as well, but it's sort of, it's exploring this visual space.
Yeah, absolutely. It's pretty out there, and you do.
There's something gratifying about.
For sure.
Just seeing a different color, like, different combination of colors just feels like.
And also the kind of like the, you haven't completely done away with, you know, logical physics. But it does. It's definitely a sidestep from what you would think. And if for anyone out there that hasn't seen it, do a Google search for Catacombs of Solaris, because it is a visual treat.
And I think what as well, it's, as you said, we have these sort of experiences with moving through these hallways and things like Doom and Wolfenstein and all these sort of games. And it really does sort of twist that on its head, and it feels like you're kind of walking through a kaleidoscope the whole way through, and you're like, am I walking the right direction, am I not?
But then all of a sudden you're like, oh no, I know where I'm at.
Yeah. And it's quite an interesting experience.
But you don't know.
You just like enjoy, and then you go,
you're lost in the pixels.
Yeah. And you get someone else to give it a go, and but I think that's it. It's sort of these experiential sort of games. Is that sort of something that you do try to aim for, to have that sort of more of an experience and something that people can kind of talk about, rather than being, you know, we're going to make sure we have 10 levels with, you know, X power-ups and monetize this and
five
that.
Five bosses.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the experience of playing games. It doesn't mean that I'm not interested in, like, more traditional kind of game play elements, but I'm having an interesting experience, you know, whether that uses more traditional elements. Like, I mean, I've created sort of, I guess, more traditional action games as well, and puzzle games, obviously. But kind of like part of the same spectrum, you're sort of creating an experience, and there's kind of like keeping the player interested in it and kind of like wanting to explore it more. So it's something that has some sort of depth to it that compels you to explore it more, I guess, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Now that Dissembler is out and people can go and enjoy it, what are you working on at the moment, or are you taking a bit of a break, and what sort of games can we look forward to from you in the future?
So I just finished a game which is going to be shown at Free Play at the party.
Coming up at the end of the month?
End of the month, yeah. Yep. So are you going to be at Free Play?
Oh, I wish. We are located on exactly the opposite coast to that one, so it's always a bit hard
to... I will be attending, hopefully, most of Free Play, and now I have another incentive to go check out the party too, if I can manage to make it to that. So hopefully I'll be at least, you know, the Pixels of representative of Free Play.
Finish that. So that's a kind of a tribute / riff of a game that I really like called Video Ball. Mm-hmm. Action Button, Tim Rogers' company. Have you heard of Video Ball?
Yes, I have actually played it on the PlayStation. It's quite a fun, good party game.
Yeah. So I was kind of just like a riff on that. So I'm feeling pretty good about it. So I'm excited to show that. And then I'm working on an action game. I made a game recently for a little jam called Salvage Jam, which is where you take a project that you've kind of abandoned and then you just polish it up and then release it like for free, right? So I released a game called Jump Grid. I just sort of put some more visuals on it. It was a game that I kind of abandoned, and I'm kind of feeling a lot better about it, like having got some good feedback and like just refreshing the way it feels, kind of like this made me more excited about it. So I think I'm going to make that into a more sort of fleshed out game, for a puzzle game. So yeah, I've got a few things going on.
And there's plenty of stuff if you want to go check out some of Ian's other work. If you're interested, you can go to ianmclarty.itch.io, and you can pick up Catacombs of Solara, so you can pick up Dissembler, which will give you PC and also on Android as well. It's on the Apple App Store as well. Ian, thank you very much for joining us. It's always, a real pleasure to discover the games that we had played and thought were really amazing and meet the people that make them. So thank you very much for making the time to speak to us today. Now, we will be sticking links up to everything up on our website, and that website is pixelsift.com.au. This episode of the podcast was produced by Michelo, Fiona, Bartholomeus, and I'm the executive producer, hosting by Scott and Sarah. Mm-hmm. You can support PixelSift by visiting the PixelSift store. That's pixelsift.com.au/store, and pick yourself up a sweet t-shirt, a tote bag, or more. And if you enter the promo code SIFTERS, you get 25% off your order. That's pixelsift.com.au/store, promo code SIFTERS. Scott, we're on social media.
Yes, you can find us on social media where you get alerts when we go live. We love your questions, and if you've got the chance to ask the developers we speak to questions each week when we're live, we're at facebook.com/pixelsift, twitter.com/pixelsift, twitch.tv/pixelsift, and youtube.com/pixelsiftau.
And Sarah, if people want to go listen to our older episodes, where should they head to?
You can go to our website to stream all your older episodes, all your favorite episodes, all the episodes. You can subscribe as a podcast either on iTunes, Pocket Cast, or using the RSS link on our page. We're live every Thursday, and next week, at the same time, join us for Pixels of Plays as we check out some of the indie games we feature on the podcast and more. And our next proper full podcast episode will be on the 24th of May.
And jump on our Twitch channel, because Mitch will be streaming Fortnite tomorrow night and a bunch of other times, so Friday night Fortnites.
Fighting at Fortnite. I'm going to shave this damn beard before next week.
Thanks, Ian.
Thank you.
Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.